Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
You're listening to Radio 3CR 855 on your AM dial, and I am Ranelil Anjum from the Norwegian University of Life Sciences.
It is difficult not to view mental health through a deeply pessimistic lens, having lived through a host of psychiatric paradigms, treatment fashions, mental health systems, and countless inquiries, only to arrive at a Royal Commission which appears to be stalling midstream. The landscape around the reform agenda is in a state of flux, with the government making a raft of decisions which seem to be taking a backward step. As of 2025, all we are seeing are ongoing tensions and problems in crisis-ridden mental health systems across not just Australia, but the wider world. Everyone is feeling the pressure of buckling systems, and not just mad people and their carers, but also the overstretched professionals who offer therapy, GPs and even psychiatrists. Mental health, mental illness, emotional distress is one big fat mess, with an even bigger mess created trying to clean it up. Into the future, the hope is that there will be enough people who care about the mad to join in a coalition of willing reformers. But there must be a meeting in the middle, a meeting between the clinical and the social holistic. Can a mental health system be radically transformed while psychiatrists hold the power? Can all parties put aside their egos, their entrenched ideologies, their owning of the truth, and step forward together to help people who struggle for their well-being in a world which is often a defeating struggle, if not toxic and injurious, in which staying mentally healthy to survive it demands constant vigilance and support? Emotional distress, mental illness is a lonely, friendless place to find oneself. Yet, we are all in this together. We cannot stand up to the world and its maddening forces alone, but we can do better if together.
Thank you so much for tuning into Radical Philosophy. I'm your host, Beth Matthews. Today on the program, I'm going to be speaking with Sandy Jeffs about her book, Out of the Madhouse. Welcome back to the program, Sandy.
Oh, thanks for having me, Beth. It's great to be here.
Could you tell us about models of madness?
And the fact that there are so many competing narratives is why I read that paragraph saying we've all got to get together and put aside our egos and our ideologies to try and come together and marry the different paradigms so that we can have meaningful reform for people who really struggle for their minds. That was a snapshot.
Right, so what was your time like in Larundel?
Well, I had 7 admissions there between 1978 and 1991. And I've got to say, you can't go to Larundel and not be affected. It was a huge madhouse. I think when I was there, there were about 700, 800 beds, you know, patients at a time, many wards, different wards. There was the locked ward where you were sent initially before you were fed out to an open ward. My time there, it wasn't too bad. I probably see it through a more friendly lens than a lot of other people. I only really had one bad experience there, which was pretty gross and pretty awful. But basically, I had good nursing experiences. It was a place where you could be away from the maddening world in a little piece of asylum. It had gardens, which were beautiful. And those gardens were a safe space to be in the daytime. At night time, they weren't so safe. So this is the paradox of Larundel. It was a paradox. During the 1970s, it was seen as a place of innovation and optimism, particularly by staff. I don't think the patients necessarily saw it through that lens. But it was, so on the one hand, it was trying to be innovative and optimistic. At the same time, it was incarcerating people. People felt like their human rights were being abused. There were varied experiences of nursing and being incarcerated for a long time. Because in those days, people would say, never let yourself be put in Larundel, you'll never get out. And in a way it was true because admissions weren't for days, they were for weeks and months, and for some people it was their lifetime of being there in the back wards. So it was a paradox of a place. It was On the one hand, hell for others. On the other hand, heaven for others, depending on what your experience was and who you spoke to. Which is why when I gathered the interviews for the book, it was so important to have a range of interviews. So I interviewed about 82 people now, and there were inmates, former nurses, former psychiatrists, social workers, psychologists, music therapist, a whole range of people who were there in various capacities. And getting the voices of all those people was so important because it was a complex place. It wasn't just a custodial, horrible, human rights violating place. It has some good points to it too, and I had some good experiences there, but so many different people had different experiences. The nurses had a fabulous time. They talk of the camaraderie of the nursing fraternity, how they had good relationships with the doctors, and you know, some worked there all their working lives. They loved it so much, and in fact there were things like pantomimes. They performed pantomimes. The nurses put on these, and the doctors together put on a couple of pantomimes. One was called Alice in the Rundle Land, and it was written by the text and libretto was written by the then chaplain Len Blair, who was a great bloke. I remember Lynn. He was the chaplain. And the music was provided by Dr. Tony Owen. He was a psychiatrist who would come into our morning meetings on Friday morning, sit at the piano and take requests. He was a brilliant pianist and he provided the music for the pantomimes. And so to see the doctors and nurses all inhabiting characters on the stage, quite mad characters, I use that word advisedly, but to see them dancing and singing and cavorting around would have been extraordinary. I mean, I have a recording of an old video of one of the pantomimes, and I never saw it in person. But the patients who did see the pantomime said they were fantastic, and seeing their doctor being a crazy character on stage really changed their relationship with the doctor.
Yeah, it sounds like there were people there who really cared. And who were these people mainly?
They did. I think the nurses cared. The nurses, I think, I don't think any nurse was there deliberately trying to make your life a hellish experience. I don't think they were there deliberately trying to make you feel bad about being there. They were working within the confines of or the construct of an institution. A big, unwieldy, total institution, and they were working within the confines of that. So in a way, they had good intentions, but sometimes those good intentions were sort of sidetracked by that big, unwieldy institution. But I think they had the best intentions. I know they kept saying that. One nurse said that whenever a new medication came on the market, they hoped that this medication would be the one that would be the magic bullet with no side effects, fix up the person's mental health issue and make them better and get them out of the hospital. They hoped for that because they could see that we were struggling with the side effects of the old-fashioned drugs that we were taking. They knew we were struggling and they really wanted the best for us, but they were working within the confines of the paradigm they were trapped in. So in a way, as much as their good intentions were well intentioned, they sometimes fell apart because the institution broke them down and broke us down.
Yeah, I could understand that. It's like working within any institution, really, isn't it?
Yes, they always have problems. Problems of being dehumanising places. But I never felt dehumanised by L'Arundel. Having said that, places like L'Arundel were what inspired the consumer movements. Those big madhouses were the ones that created the consumer movement that evolved in the 60s and 70s. People were responding to the dehumanising experience they would have had in the madhouses, forming organisations that were there to critique and to ultimately close them.
Now, you touched on this before, but could you tell us a bit more about the so-called cures and treatments back then?
Oh, God. Well, we were plied with the old-fashioned typical antipsychotic drugs. So starting off with chlorpromazine, or Lagactyl, it was colloquially called. It was developed in the 1950s, the first antipsychotic drug to be developed. That was the first drug I took. It was heralded as a breakthrough drug that they said that it was the drug that was responsible for emptying out the madhouses of the 1950s. And in a way, it sort of did. But then they discovered that the side effects started to emerge. And one of the side effects, which we all lived in fear of getting, was called tardive dyskinesia, where people had lip smacking, body contortions, jerking body, jerking face, and, you know, it's a horrible sort of thing to get. And once you got it, it was irreversible. There was no drug to counter the effects of it. We live with the fear of that every day. So drugs like Stelazine, Modicate, Pimazide, Melarol, those drugs were the old drugs, and they all had that side effect possibility. We did the Stelazine Stomp. It was called the Stelazine Stomp, where we had endless restlessness in our legs and our minds, and we couldn't sit still for a second without jiggling our legs or treading water as we stood on the floor. Horrible, horrible side effect. It was relentless. And another side effect we had was the Modicate Shuffle. From the Modicate was a injectable drug. It was in sesame oil, so it was slow acting. You got it either once a week, fortnight, or month, depending on the dosage. But what it did was it caused what was called pseudo-Parkinsonism. So it made you look like you had Parkinson's disease. So your face was like cardboard, your body was rigid, your hands would be shaking, and when you walked, you could only shuffle because you were so stiff, your muscles were so stiffened. And it was called the Modicate Shuffle. And if you went to Larundel back in the 70s, even the early 80s or the 80s, if you went into a ward of people, you'd see them either shuffling or stomping around or having faraway looks in their eyes or being soporific and some somnambulist sort of stuff. You know, people were often over-medicated, bombed out to being like zombies. It was really hard work. And I remember how my head felt like it was just stuffed with cotton wool. The drugs were so invasive. And they were what we had at the time. And it was hard work having to deal with those side effects, and really with sometimes minimal therapeutic impact. And they do now admit that the dosages they gave us of those drugs were way and above what was a therapeutic level, and in fact they were dangerous. And the folly of the day was that when you didn't respond to a medication, they just kept upping the dosage, basically, and upping the dosage until you were rendered like a zombie. So it was hard work. But having said that, if you went into a ward at Larundel, you wouldn't have seen a whole lot of obese people in the ward.
I suppose it was that constant movement, wasn't
it? Well, it was just that the drugs didn't cause obesity. Like the drugs we have now, olanzapine, Seroquel, cause you to stack on your weight big time. You can go into a ward 70 kilos and come out 3 weeks later 90 kilos. Because it changes your metabolism and they just cause weight gain. So I don't recall Arundel having a lot of overweight people in the wards, but we were rendered like zombies instead. So trade off.
So what was it, do you think, that brought the psychiatrists into Arundel?
Yeah, good question. In the 50s and 60s, a lot of psychiatrists came from England, because I don't think Australia had a big psychiatry component in terms of training, medical training. So a lot of them came to Larundel, and when they came to Larundel in those times, the 50s, 60s, 70s, there were actually houses all along Plenty Road that had been built for the psychiatrists to live in. So they got a package. They got a house, they got money, they got the whole package for being at Larundel, and it was a thing. But it was also a very important teaching hospital. It had what was called the Muriel Yarrington School of Psychiatric Nursing, and it was known Australia-wide as a very progressive and innovative nursing school. And so Larundel was a teaching hospital, so it had the nursing school, and psychiatrists would also come there to do their rotations for their psychiatric training. So they were there in this innovative, optimistic place. They were doing, the nurses were training on site. It was the apprenticeship model of training. So nurses from day one would be in the wards with patients as they did their 3-year course in psychiatric nursing. So it's changed. Now psychiatric nursing is just an add-on to a nursing degree, a few months add-on. Whereas with the apprenticeship model, the nurses learnt from day one how to be with patients in the ward. So they gained skills very early on about being with mental patients and people who are in emotional distress. Now they do their add-on nursing, psychiatric nursing component, get to a public psychiatric ward and freak out because they have no idea how to deal, how to be with psychiatric patients. They don't know how to do it. And so they get freaked out and sort of end up leaving or don't do a very good job. So L'Arundel had that nursing school. It was a teaching hospital. So a lot of people in the mental health world now, a lot of psychiatrists in the mental health world now would have passed through L'Arundel at some stage because it was so well regarded as a teaching hospital.
Yeah, I think that's so important to have that contact with people. I remember once watching this woman with Huntington's career. And what she used to do, she used to completely relax all her muscles. So she'd basically sit in a chair, but her head was basically between her ankles. Mm. And she'd just be in that position, was comfortable for her. And then they asked a student nurse to come along. I might have been a student doctor, actually, to come along and read to her. And you could see that this woman was sitting there and she was reading. And as people were walking in and out of the room, she looked a bit embarrassed. She felt, I could tell by her body language, she felt like she was sitting there and she was reading to no one. Well, All of a sudden, this woman, Jill, she jumped up and said, I agree with that. That's right. And then just went straight back into nosedive into her ankles again. And the way this trainee doctor continued to read after that, she got that positive feedback and she realised she wasn't reading to no one. She was reading to somebody who was hanging on every word.
Mm. Wow. The power of connection.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And the nurses at L'Arundel did connect with the patients often over a cigarette. So, because in those days you could smoke inside, and the walls were brown with cigarette smoke stain. It was quite gross to see. And some wards had a particular room that was dedicated to it as a smoking room, and the walls were dark brown in those rooms. It was just horrible. But because everyone smoked, including the nurses, it was often the time for the nurses and patients to make a connection. The nurses say, let's just go and have a cigarette and have a chat. So they go into the courtyard and have a cigarette, and over that cigarette they would have a meaningful chat about what's going on. And that was the way the therapeutic alliance was created at L'Arundel with the nurses and patients. That cigarette. The cigarette culture was huge at L'Arundel. It was people botting cigarettes, people desperate for cigarettes, cigarettes being the only comfort they had in a ward where they couldn't get out, sharing cigarettes or leaving a cigarette half-smoked so somebody could pick up the rest of the cigarette and finish it off because they didn't have a cigarette. And cigarettes were also used for sex in L'Arundel, trading cigarettes for sex with women. That was horribly a horrible part of L'Arundel. There'd be a bloke who used to drive through L'Arundel's grounds because the grounds were quite big and you could drive right through from Plenty Road to Waiora Road, and he would stop and offer female patients cigarettes for sex. That was quite horrible.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Geez, yeah, you don't sort of think of that angle of it. Look, after you've spent so much time there, it must have been pretty emotional when L'Arundel closed.
Yes, to see it gone, and most of the buildings have been bulldozed. They've left a couple. The big two-storey building where A and B ward were is now a facade, and they're building apartments behind the facade. Mm. When I go past L'Arundel down Plenty Road and see it's gone, my history has been bulldozed. So much of my life was tied up with L'Arundel and those admissions I had. And to see it gone and my history being erased from memory is quite – it's interesting. Some people – I know Julie Dempsey, who I interviewed, initially thought, oh, when L'Arundel was bulldozed, oh, that place of torture is gone. Isn't that great? But then she then reflected and thought, no, what we have now is no better than L'Arundel, and so it's worse than L'Arundel. And she's sad to see it gone. Yeah, so I drive past and have a pang of sadness because it's gone. But then, you know, its time had come and we can't go back to L'Arundel and those big madhouses. So am I nostalgic about it? I'm probably nostalgic when I shouldn't be. I should be more critical, but I have nostalgia. And, in fact, I think we should be putting monuments on these sites to commemorate all who passed through L'Arundel, because it wasn't just the patients, it was the staff as well. Everyone was touched by L'Arundel in some way if you've been there, and even the nurses were touched in a significant way by their time there as working as nurses. A lot of my mad comrades who were there Some found it to be a place of asylum. It was a way of getting away from the world and being screened and protected from the world, because it was isolated and it was a place in itself. And now we don't have that opportunity really to have a piece of asylum. And in fact, we've trashed the word asylum by the constant association of asylum with illegal immigrants and queue jumpers and all that horrible narrative we have about asylum seekers being these terrible people we have to get rid of. The word itself has become tarnished, and no one now associates it with being a safe haven, a refuge. We associate it with the politics of what we do to these poor people.
Are there ways to recover, do you think?
Yes, and in my book I have three stories of recovery. There's my own, plus Heidi Everett's and Julie Dempsey. Both women are absolute guns in what they do. I think, see, now people say talking about recovery is quite toxic, because if you say recovery, you're implying you've been ill. And people who don't like the illness model don't want to talk about recovery. They talk about healing instead. Can you heal? Can you? Well, I don't know how to talk about these things. It's such a politicised space now. And how do you talk about it without upsetting someone? I don't know. But I never say I'm a paragon of recovery. I'd never say that. But I've found a way to get past being just a psych patient. A lot of people get trapped in being just a psych patient. A lot of people back in the Rundle's time were trapped in Larundel, trapped as just being a psych patient, and their life didn't have much else meaning to it. I used to measure the passing of time by my Modicate injections and my psychiatrist appointments. That's how I marked time passing. That's a pathway to nowhere. So now my life is much bigger and more meaningful, and having friends who have supported me, a place to call home, a safe place to call home where I'm safe and protected and feel at ease. Having my team Sandy, as I've probably talked about before in the other interviews, having my meaningful work in terms of my writing gives me meaning. Being in my orchestras gives me meaning. I play the violin in the Footscray Gypsy Orchestra and a local orchestra. Having playing hockey, you know, being in hockey teams, having the camaraderie of team sport, all these things are little elements that pointers in your life which give you hope, purpose and meaning. Without hope, purpose and meaning, life is very tricky and very challenging. What gives a person hope, purpose and meaning? How can we restore people's hope, purpose and meaning when it's been taken away from them? For a lot of people, Larundel did represent lost dreams. Unfortunately, sad lost dreams. And how do you give people back their dreams? How do you give them back a reason to get out of bed? And for me, it's about having many things in my life that are elements of Team Sandy, and that's important for me. It might be taking medication, it might be seeing my psychologist, but it's about other things too, other broader, bigger things in your life.
On a lighter note, look, I've got to ask this. Do you think Larundel's haunted?
it's a good question, because it seems that any institution that's been closed down has its own ghost stories. And Larundel has its ghost stories. There's apparently a music box which plays at night time. Because when people used to go into the old ruins before they bulldozed them, and I've done this in daytime, go through the fence and risk the $10,000 fine and go into the buildings. And I took a whole lot of photos. I've got a book of Larundel photos of the vandalised parts of Larundel where I'd been. I haven't been there at night time, but people who went there at night time, the urban explorers, talk about the music box that they hear and maybe seeing the ghost of a woman in a white shroud who would walk around the corridors at night time. I don't believe in ghost stories, but they're not uncommon with closed institutions. Every old institution has a ghost story, and that's in itself is interesting. Why is this so? Because there's the idea of all these haunted souls being there, you know, they're places of haunted people and their souls being damaged by what's happened to them and by being there. And the idea of all these haunted souls wandering the corridors of the closed institution has sort of filtered into the ghost stories, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, so is there anything else you'd like to add about?
People often ask what we've lost and what we've gained by closing L'Arundel. Mm-hmm. And so we've lost and gained a few things. We lost the sense of camaraderie and a sense of community that the staff and inmates had, because long admissions really inspired a lot of camaraderie and forming relationships with other patients and also with the nurses. We lost the apprenticeship model of training. We lost the curative gardens. We lost the notion of asylum. L'Arundel also had for a time a therapeutic community called Faulkner House, and that was where people would spend many months, not up to 9, 12 months, doing intensive group therapy. No drugs were involved, no medications, but it was intensive group therapy. And Daniel Carnes, the psychiatrist who ran it, was a very charismatic character who played the cello. That was closed down in the late 1970s when the talking cure lost favour and the medical model and medicating people became more in vogue, and the idea of spending a lot of money talking with people was lost because it wasn't seen as a cost-benefit analysis. We've lost the time in which to find equilibrium, so we don't find our equilibrium in a psych ward now in 10 days. You get discharged mad because someone mad and needs your bed. That's a real problem. We gained carer and consumer activism from those madhouses. They inspired people to form carer and consumer groups. We got the Mental Health Act. The Mental Health Act was, several of them now, was drawn up to protect people from incarceration and from psychiatry. we've now gained the living and lived experience workforce, peer support, living and lived experience workforce. People with lived experience in now working in government, working in NGOs. That's been a gain since L'Arundel closed, and the impetus to have people involved in their recovery with is a bit more in vogue than it used to be. And some of the consequences of L'Arundel and closing is that families became the main carers. When they closed L'Arundel, people went back to their families, basically, and families became the main caring paradigm. And that was problematic because they were often doing it unsupported, unresourced, not with the skills to care for someone with complex mental health issues. Now we have more people homeless and in jails. The jails are full of people with psychosis. That's really, really, really bad. And we have now public psych wards, which are just hell holes. Nobody wants to be in a public psych ward. My mad comrades talk about public psych wards as though they're coming back from the front, like soldiers coming home from the front, such as the trauma that these trauma factories generate when they're so bad. They're such toxic places that they are trauma factories. So there's some of the consequences and the losses and the gains from L'Arundel.
Oh, it's quite major, isn't it? It's really, a lot of things that I think people just don't think about unless you've sort of been in the system and had all of this happening to you.
Writing our book was a labour of love that Margie and I wrote it. I had the idea for it and then asked Margie to come on board because I had a mountain of transcripts, a mountain of interviews. I was drowning in the project I thought I was doing. I thought I was going to write a history of L'Arundel, but it turned out to be an oral history and recollections and looking at the mental health system now. But bringing Margie on board was really great because she has her expertise in carer advocacy. But it was a labour of love. I just wanted people to be reminded that L'Arundel existed because now people don't know that it even existed. And people in mental health, workers, nurses, doctors, people, consumers don't know that L'Arundel existed and have no idea about it. And we can't forget it. It was a major institution in Melbourne. Everyone knew L'Arundel, as well as Mont Park, Plenty and Royal Park as well, the other hospitals. But it was such a cultural icon of Melbourne that everyone would know L'Arundel and what it stood for. And to have that forgotten now, to forget the history of psychiatry, the history of consumer politics, the history of all these things is so sad because, you know, we need to know it existed because to know where old consumers like me came from, old farts like me who were in the system back then, now in the system, dealing with people who have no idea what we've been through and what our experience of those madhouses was, and that's a problem.
Yeah, it certainly is. So thanks very much for coming onto the program today.
Well, thanks for having me.
and I've been speaking with Sandy Jeffs about her book, Out of the Madhouse. Hope you've enjoyed the program, and do stay tuned next month.